Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. It's a butter egg made from plants. Bring more customers in your doors with Just Egg. Start with a free sample at ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meet and Three, we rethink surplus by exploring how innovators are promoting sharing mindsets and responding to excess in creative ways.
The whole life cycle of food would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter behind China and the United States if it were a country.
You know, in the age of COVID, where a lot of those institutional processors did grind to a halt and a lot of farms had to dump milk in Pennsylvania, even while supermarket cases were bare, the organic market stayed strong.
They source all of these ingredients, they do all of this work, and then they just boil it for a few minutes and then they throw it away.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, hello, Heritage Radio Network listeners tuning in from 165 countries around the world, about a million listens a month. And today we have a kind of, I think, special episode. I mean, all of our episodes are great and I really like them all for different reasons, but this is a milestone. We are officially at the 1 year mark of producing Tech Bites remotely because of the global pandemic. And I thought it would be a nice moment to bring back some guests from the course of the past year and talk about how the year has gone for them and what they are looking forward to. We did episode 200 of Tech Bites back on March 17th, 2020. It was the first one we did remotely because New York City had just gone into a lockdown. We recorded remotely via Zencastr, which was the first time we were using all of that new technology. And I think that preemptively, the Heritage Radio Network staff had started moving into that remote recording actually a week or two before. And from my end, as a host and a producer, it really came off seamlessly. But I want to ask Matt Patterson, who is here with us as the engineer. You don't often hear him, but he is always here making sure things run smoothly and the show gets produced and published. Matt, how has the past year been for you from the tech HRN side?
It's been pretty good, all things considered. I mean, yeah, you experienced that change as being quite smooth, and I'm glad for that. And it kind of was, because we had already used a lot of these technologies in producing Meet and Three, which is like, you know, our kind of
the weekly news
flagship
show.
News show, yeah, which had a lot more remote recordings before anybody else did. And yeah, so we sort of knew the technology, although I think I personally had like barely used, you know, Zencastr or any of these, and we've experimented with a few of them over time and learned what works and what doesn't. But yeah, it was a pretty quick change. And then, you know, working remotely has its ups and downs, but there were some good things organizationally. Like we, you know, we use Slack now, and it's like actually quite helpful for our team, I think, for internal communications and keeping things more organized, onboarding people a little more quickly. And it's gone pretty smooth, actually.
Looking back, it was okay.
Yeah. And now it's funny. I mean, we're at the point where we're starting to ask questions about like, hey, wait, when are we going back to the studio? And what will that
look
like?
Are we going back to the studio?
I mean, eventually, I'm sure. Yeah. but then, yeah, there is also the question of like, you know, what do hosts want? And certainly for the next, I expect us will be in a big transitional period for at least the rest of this year. But I could totally see a point where there's a blend. So I don't know. things feel a little more uncertain again, whereas they were very uncertain at the beginning. Then they sort of smoothed out. We're like, all right, we know what we're doing. We expect this to last a long time. And now they're starting to edge back towards uncertainty where we don't know what the future will look like.
That's an interesting observation. And I think you're absolutely right. There definitely is a feeling right now of what's happening next in a substantial way. What would you say the biggest surprise was for you over the course of the past year? Perhaps a pandemic positive, as a few people on this show have talked about, or, you know, just, I mean, the whole thing is wildly unexpected, but is there something that stands out to you?
I mean, keeping it generally within this realm of conversation, I would say the thing that surprises me or has surprised me most is that a number of hosts have actually seemed quite positive on recording remotely in a way that I would have expected there to be just like more tech hesitancy and whatnot. But I do think a number of people really took advantage of that and just decided like, okay, well, if I can interview people anywhere, I'm going to interview people who I normally wouldn't, who are further away. I'll organize episodes around things that are a little more geographically dispersed and just like view that all as a positive. And so, yeah, I'm going to be very interested to see, you know, like what all the hosts of shows really want as we come into this next period of all this. But
what's the thing that you miss the most about the studio?
I think I get fired if I don't say Roberta's pizza, which is probably actually
that's not
just
true. You could say missing seeing the hosts live and in person.
Missing seeing the hosts.
You could say that. I think that could easily supersede Roberta's pizza.
That is true. I would have said normal social interaction, but I've actually forgotten what that's like, so I didn't think to say it. I miss the people. I miss the food, and I miss the, like, I mean, man, it was just a lot. It was a lot smoother sailing, I would say. There was an ease of, like, you know, you come in, you have normal conversations with people, plan things, do it, move on. it was a lot less juggling.
Yeah. Well, I for one really want to take a moment to applaud all the work that you have done along with the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio, because it's been a great transition on the host and producer side. And I mean, we'll hear from our guests today, but I have to say, on a personal note, sitting down once a week to do this show with you over the course of the past year, talking with so many people who, in light of something that was like truly disaster, you know, really managed to find ways to, you know, pivot and innovate and put some good things into the world. So it was a really, over the course of the past year, the show's been, you know, sort of a great mile marker on my calendar, have show to do every week, which is really helpful. And also just the opportunity, as you said earlier, to talk to people from around the world and really kind of find those stories of, you know, perseverance and resilience and moving forward was, you know, helpful and gratifying to me, and hopefully, you know, helpful to people who were listening as well. So I say hats off to you, Matt, and it's nice to hear you every now and again.
Well, thank you.
So we have with us two guests today who faithful listeners will really recognize. First, we have Deepti Sharma, who actually was on episode 200 a year ago and did the first remote recording with us. She is the founder and CEO of two companies. One is called Food to Eat. The other is called Bicky. And she also really took the time this year to dig into her activism and ran for city council in District 24 in Queens. Deepti, thank you for joining us. I want to tell you that an anecdote that I share over and over again on this show and in real life is when we were doing the episode, you said, "It's so great to be here. It's just like coming home." And it that has just stuck with me so much over the course of this past year, because you were at home when you said that, but your actual home. But there was something, I think, intangible about the collection of people talking about a specific subject in a specific way that resonated with you in a visceral way, that was sort of that intangible thing. And it's that intangible thing that I think we've been looking for so hard this year. And also that intangible thing is the thing that, you know, restaurants and hospitality businesses and theater and museums have been trying to figure out what the alchemy of that is, to sort of try and bring that to their customers and their clients and their audience in a virtual way. So I want to thank you for coming back. We're going to be excited to hear about, you know, all the things that you've done and how your businesses are going. But do you remember saying that? And do you remember what had come to mind when you did?
It's funny, I don't remember saying that, but I can see myself saying that. I think it was just more the comfort of being around you and the people that, you know, I love listening to your show because you're very thoughtful when you ask questions, the amount of research you do. And I think home is just like hearing your voice sometimes, right? And just feeling comfortable when you're asking me these questions and asking about what's going on in my life. And so I don't know what I was thinking per se, but I think it's just the comfort of knowing that like you're someone that I respect in the industry. And, you know, it's really rare to find people that like ask the questions that aren't often asked. So I'd say that's probably what I was thinking. And it's rare to have that level of comfort with people that are interviewing you.
Oh, well, I will 100% take that and thank you. And I do try and put a lot of thought into things, and I do try and ask people questions that maybe no one's asked them before, because I think and hope that that's why people come to this show, to hear, you know, really a different point of view, mm-hmm. About maybe a story or an idea that they already know, but maybe they get to experience it in a little bit of a different way. You're always such a great guest to have on because your businesses are about the restaurant business. Your clients and colleagues are restaurants. So for people who may be meeting Deepti for the first time here, her business, Food to Eat, is essentially corporate catering, where she has a stable of restaurants, many of them women and minority owned. And then she has businesses that are the clients who are looking to book corporate events, you know, back in the before times when there were breakfast meetings in a conference room,
yeah,
or lunch meetings, or, you know, an after work presentation that required snacks. Food to Eat would be the organizational arm of that for the corporate client, and then pull through, you know, this offering of local restaurants. Her company, Bicky, is CRM for restaurants. So that's the tech and data side of restaurants also. So how her business is doing is a really great indicator of how the business is doing. So tell us, you know, how Food to Eat and Bicky have gone over the past year.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting because they're both very different businesses, and it's very reflective of what's happening in, you know, in our world right now. So Food to Eat last year essentially literally went to zero revenue because nobody was doing and hosting events. And even now, as like events are slowly coming back, people are still not like running towards having in-person events. I think they're taking it one day at a time and slowly hosting things. So when it comes to corporate catering, we have some things happening, but it's really, really minimal. But in the last year, we essentially pivoted into food insecurity work. You know, we saw that the industry was essentially failing and needed help. And we saw people in the industry lost their jobs that were, you know, driving them to go food insecure. And so we started fundraising and applying for grants. We've fed over 150,000 meals in the last year through crowdfunding, grants, and partnerships with organizations like Rural Central Kitchen. And that has been like the majority of the work that we've been focusing on, is just making sure that we buy meals from local restaurants that are still open, that are immigrant, women, minority, you know, Black and brown owned. and then giving those meals out to community members that, you know, need the help, working with pantries, working with, you know, we worked with a domestic violence shelter last year. So we've just been kind of focusing on community work and making sure that we can help restaurants through this really tough time, while doing, again, like little bits and pieces of corporate catering work. But again, like I said, there hasn't been much going on, and whatever we have been doing has been like very COVID, you know, quote unquote friendly, just making sure everything is individually wrapped and packed so that people are comfortable when they're getting their meal. It's not the traditional catered meal where you're kind of putting a plate together for yourself. So it's interesting to see how that's changed in the corporate catering setting. And our second company, Bicky, has soared. It's gone in the other direction, interestingly enough, because the industry has changed. People are now realizing in the restaurant industry how important their digital footprint is and how important keeping relationships with their customers is, because the only way they can really have real relationships right now on a large scale is digitally. And so at Bicky, you know, we essentially are a CRM for restaurants. We aggregate data from their third-party services and help them understand that data so that they can build stronger relationships with their customers. And instead of just giving out discounts, like that's the one thing that's really bothered me about the restaurant industry when it comes to marketing, is let's just give out a free cup of coffee or free this and lure people to come in, or discounts, right? Everyone has gone through this Groupon model, and we forget that the reason why a restaurant, like a patron comes to a restaurant, is because I enjoy the food. I enjoy the friendly banter that I have when I'm getting my cup of, you know, coffee or juice or whatever that may be. And you can build that loyalty digitally as well. Obviously, it's not going to be the same, but you can build that loyalty through your brand, through your story. And that's what we're really helping people do through Bicky. And so it's interesting, while Food to Eat took this bit of a hit because we're very service in, you know, driven, Bicky, on the other hand, has grown. You know, we've raised a round. We're actually going through that right now. And, you know, I started the business with my husband, and he's the CEO of that business. But, you know, I have now taken an advisory role. But it's just interesting to see how, because the world changed so quickly, our business has changed. And Bicky is, you know, kind of going through this interesting time where people are realizing how important it is for them to have these relationships now digitally.
Certainly a digital life has become critical. You know, I think maybe a year ago, before the pandemic, we've had many conversations on this show with different people about different, you know, digital platforms and social media. And, you know, there was a little bit of a question about what type of digital footprint your restaurant or business had to have online. Should you have social media? Should you be on Instagram? Do you need to do delivery? All those types of things. And today, all of those questions have been answered with a resounding yes, absolutely, 1,000%. You need every single one of those things if you're going to survive. It's also an interesting juxtaposition that you are raising around and doing some financing, because, you know, this pandemic has also been really an interesting story, an unfortunate story, perhaps, and a sobering story of, there's a lot of people who are making a lot of money, and there's a lot of money out there. There's money for investing in innovations and startups and the stock market and all of those things, while there are tremendous numbers of people who are really struggling on a survival level. And the discrepancy that we're seeing is not getting better as of yet. And it's almost, you know, the chasm is almost widening. I think that that is probably something that our second guest, Eliza Lower, who is the executive director of the Food Education Fund, which is Food and Finance High School in New York City. It is a public high school that kids go to when they want to be in the restaurant business. And we've been a long, long time fan of the Food and Finance High School here at Tech Bites and at Heritage Radio Network. We've done radio scholarship programs and had the students on and participated in lots of different programs at the school. It's a really great place and one of the only high schools of its kind, and certainly the only high school of its kind in New York City. And it is a public school, though, and it is preparing kids to go into an industry right now that's being decimated. But they're really positive about it. And actually, interestingly, Eliza, maybe you can tell us about the first pivot that you all made at the very beginning also, which was much like DeepD, pivoting into food security and helping to feed your students and your families and kind of creating that network really, really very early on.
Yeah, hello. And thank you for having me on. Yeah, so this day of kind of the March 16th, March 15th has been something I've been watching on the calendar just because I think anniversaries in this world are so kind of telling. And I think we're all sitting back thinking of where we were a year ago. And it's so we actually, as Food Education Fund, is the nonprofit that supports food and finance, and actually now two other schools, High School of Hospitality Management and Brooklyn STEAM. We had our big fundraiser on March 9th of last year, which was kind of the day before the world shut down. So last week, last year, we had our big fundraiser. And then later that week, we were already doing a big food distribution because it was very likely that schools were about to be shut down. And so many of our students, 85% of whom live below the poverty line and the other 15%, many very close to that. A lot of them get their only meal of the day at school. So we actually did a big food distribution on March 13th of kind of giving things out as quickly as we could before kids went home. And then when March 15th hit, that was the same day that schools announced that they were shutting down. It was like a Sunday evening, and also that restaurants had to close. So our original thought was like, okay, there's all these restaurants that will have extra food that's going to go bad, and there's all these families that need that food. So we set up a food hub website and also a food map where restaurants could list the food that they had available and when it was available to pick up, which we had, I think, like 20,000 views of that, but we honestly really don't know how well it worked. And something that kind of slapped us in the face was just, I think, kind of the base of equity, as in a lot of the restaurants we work with are in Manhattan or kind of downtown Brooklyn, and a lot of the families we work with are an hour and a half to 2 hours away. And I think that whole kind of situation encapsulates so much of what goes wrong, honestly, with a lot of nonprofits and programs. Is there's this thing that feels like it's so makes so much sense. But if you're not really thinking about where people are and meeting them where they're at, it doesn't do the good that you're hoping for.
And that's actually like an actual physical geographical meeting them where
right.
they're at, not
an
intellectual conceptual idea, but actually you are in a different borough from the restaurant that has the food. How do we resolve that?
I think kind of both too, because they in theory could have come to Manhattan, but there are also families that are, you know, dealing with schools closing down and fear and parents that might still be working. So the next step that we did was to create a food distribution where families had choices, and also there was last mile delivery, which I have learned are very hard things to do in terms of food distribution. But we were fortunate to have one of our board members, Questlove, was raising funds for that. So we went to one of our partners, Ace Endico, and they set up this account for the families where the families had $200 to like choose what they wanted from this portal. And then there were all these other donations on top of that that got delivered to the houses, which was kind of the ideal structure, and also almost broke us just because the logistics of that. And it was we have 800 students. There's about 800 families as a part of that. And we were a team of three people then. So that was, I am so glad that we did it. We were able to get, it was like 3 weeks of food per family. And also it was just so complicated and challenging to figure that out. So we've gone through a few different models. We are now on a pickup model in a few different places because things have opened back up and families are able to pick up. But we honestly thought we would be doing food distribution, which I would imagine DeepD is in a similar spot of for, you know, maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months until someone else stepped in, or, you know, maybe that's the government, maybe that's another organization. But it has been amazing to see how many nonprofits that did not originally do food distribution are continuing to do food distribution today. And I think honestly disheartening, because I think that that speaks to the huge need still and the lack of structures that we have as a society to feed people when something goes wrong. So that's we're not sure. We'll probably do it at least until June. But we're also looking at some other programs of how we, it was another thing that we did in the beginning was alumni emergency grants. And we had an application that I'm like touching my heart right now, just because it always feels so intense to think about this. Of we usually have about 16 alums apply for a scholarship. We had about 90 applications in the first 24 hours. Wow. And I think 80% of them, we asked them about immediacy of need, of just self-reporting, just because we had a certain amount of funds and wanted to prioritize who really needed it. But it was about 80% of people that were either 0 to 3 months or immediate need. And looking at the names, a lot of these were like valedictorians, got full ride scholarships to CIA or Johnson & Wales. And it just showed so clearly how the culinary industry, as it was structured, did not set people up to have a safety net. And also how big of a disparity and racial disparity there is between hourly employees and salaried employees. It's just heartbreaking.
I don't think that the industry has actually changed. I think it probably still is like that. Yeah. But, you know, an awareness is certainly there. And I don't know that people know how to make that change or fix it quite yet. One of the things I think that is resonant about the one-year anniversary is I don't think anybody thought we would have a one-year anniversary. I think initially when, you know, everyone got sent home and, you know, we're in lockdown for a while, and as things progressed, I think everybody thought like the resolution of this was just around the corner. It'll be a few weeks. It'll be a few months, you know, by the spring, by the summer, by the fall, by the turn of the year. And I think it's amazing to say we're at a one-year anniversary of this pandemic, because I don't think anybody really truly anticipated that. And also not really knowing what the next anniversary is. I think Matt's earlier comment of, you know, it was so surprising and you didn't know what to do, and then everybody figured out how to, or, you know, found some sort of way to navigate the new situation, and now we're at a precipice of what's going to happen next. It's really hard to maintain a level of like energy and work and enthusiasm for an unknown period of time. I mean, you know, you can run a marathon, you know, it's 26 miles, right? People do it all the time. Mm-hmm. And it's, from what I understand, extremely challenging. I don't think I could do it, but you know, people do it and they pace themselves because they know it's 26 miles, but we have no idea like how long this marathon is. So it's hard to pace yourself and your resources and the enthusiasm, you know, of people to participate and, you know, help support things. So it's really challenging. We are going to take a quick break and find out who is supporting us in this show. Over the past year, we have had a number of really fantastic sponsors. We too have had grants, and we've had a lot of support from our members who are listeners like you. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. We keep the lights on and the mics hot out of generosity of all of you and companies like this one. This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based customers into your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol, and less saturated fat. And it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also frozen, pre-baked, folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres called Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "So good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn. We are talking about the one-year anniversary of the global pandemic, almost a year to the day of the first remotely recorded episode of Tech Bites. We are talking with Deepti Sharma, founder and CEO of Food to Eat, founder of Bicky, and recently ran for city council in District 24 in Queens. If you want to follow her online and learn more about her and her businesses, foodtoeat.com, at Food to Eat on social media. Bicky is BIKKY.com, Bicky HQ on social media. And if you want to follow Deepti, she is Deepti NYC, DEEPTINYC. Eliza Lower is joining us. She is with the Food Education Fund that supports Food and Finance High School and now two other schools. If you want to find them on social media at Food Education Fund, they are online, foodeducationfund.org. The students also miraculously, and we'll talk about that, we'll talk about this next, produced a magazine during lockdown remotely called Pass the Spatula, the junior class last year. It's a great, great actual print magazine. You can follow them on social media at Pass the Spatula. And look back in the Tech Bites archives because we have lots of episodes with both of these women talking about these organizations. Something that both of you very much, you know, have in common in your organizations is being really responsive to what's happening, you know, I would say like on the ground in an actual, this is what's happening in my community, this is what's happening with my people. You're both acutely aware of what is happening in the restaurant industry, really being, you know, just decimated by what's happening because of the lack of social safety net support, because of, you know, us being required to be physically distant. I would love to hear from both of you, you know, having come through the year, I'm going to say successfully, maybe in a different way, but really having been proactive and really worked hard to kind of like cross the 1 year line. What do each of you see in the short term with the restaurant industry and how that's going to impact your, you know, colleagues, students, constituents, and businesses? Deepti, what are you seeing for the next, you know, 3 to 6 months?
Honestly, it's hard to tell. I think that, you know, I talk to restaurants and a lot of them are trying to be hopeful right now just because the weather is getting better, people are getting vaccinated. They're being deemed as essential when it comes to vaccines now, like they can actually go and get a vaccine and are being prioritized. So restaurants are hopeful, but at the same time, you can tell that it's like, it's not hopeful to the 100%, right? They're trying to be hopeful because they want to just be optimistic given the year that they've been through, but there's still a part of them that feels like, what if, like, you know, the rug just gets pulled underneath us, and like, what happens? What do we do? So, you know, right now the restaurants, they're just trying to prepare for a summer in which, you know, things will be a little bit more open. They can continue doing outdoor dining. People will be responsibly and safely dining with them, and that's their hope. But the relief is really important, and how they get access to this relief and what that means. And, you know, I'm still getting calls trying to, like, what I'm trying to do is now read the plan, try to understand what that plan means for each restaurant and who can actually apply for these grants through this, you know, the American Rescue Plan that's been written and given out, being given out slowly. So, honestly, it's hard to tell, and I don't want to set anything out and put anything, set anything in stone, because as we know, this past year has been so unpredictable, and I think that the same is going to be for this next 6 months, because just because they have a good summer doesn't mean, you know, people are going to come back to work, especially for those restaurants that are in Midtown Manhattan that literally depended on people working from their offices. Like, that was probably a majority of their revenue. 70% of their revenue probably came from catered meals or, you know, those group orders that were coming in from the finance companies that they were servicing. I always think about like the fast casual restaurants like Dig In or Sweetgreen. All of them have been affected as well. I mean, obviously not as much as the mom and pops, but, you know, these restaurants opened in all of Manhattan. They had multiple locations because they were, you know, again, they were expecting a certain type of clientele to be coming there. So I will say, I think that, like, you know, given that people are still not going back to work, you know, we haven't heard any of the large companies saying that they're going back to work. And so that there is going to be that huge effect on these Manhattan-based restaurants that primarily, you know, we're dependent on that traffic. You know, with Broadway opening up, maybe there might be things changing because there will be more tourists coming in or more people coming in to watch shows and whatnot. But I think that they're, you know, as excited as people are for the summer, I'm still kind of scared considering there's a huge chunk of people that that were the, you know, everyday business for restaurants that aren't going to be there. So, you know, similar to what Eliza was talking about earlier, relief is going to have to continue, right? The fact that so many organizations like us that didn't do food insecurity work before are now doing it. You know, I'm talking to pantries in my neighborhood that I live in just to make sure that they have exactly what they need. And I'm trying to deliver fresh fruits and vegetables to them every week. So as much as I can bring in hot meals, I try to bring in produce as well, because canned goods aren't going to cut it, right? And so for me, what's most important is just to continue doing this work, making sure that I'm providing the relief to the organizations that have been doing this for years, because they still don't have what they need. And that's like the saddest thing to continue to see, that we're a year in to this pandemic and we're still dealing with more of the same.
Haven't quite figured out how to solve those problems while they're happening a year in. Do you think that it's meaningful, Deepti, that in the recent relief package that the assistance monies are prioritized to go to women and minority-owned businesses first?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because we've seen this and I've heard these stories plenty through the interviews that I've done in this past 10 years of running Food to Eat, is that access to capital is one of the biggest, you know, factors that doesn't allow women in Black and Brown businesses to actually just get started on their own initially. So the fact that they're doing that is really important. I mean, I've been getting texts in the past year from women-owned businesses that haven't been prioritized with the PPP loans that went out. And so I think it's a huge deal that they are doing that. And I'm glad that they're prioritizing women and minority-owned businesses, because it's essential when it comes to capital.
Well, maybe just the outlines of what the relief package is indicates that people are being heard and government officials are starting to actually see and recognize what some of the critical issues are. Eliza, you are getting ready to reopen the school after a year.
Yes. So the schools are going back on March 22nd, which apparently the new school's chancellor found out on the news along with all of us. So
that's how it works here. We find things out on the news and TV.
Twitter is how exactly. Most principals mm-hmm. and people mm-hmm. find things out, which is
TV.
Shocking.
I saw it on TV.
Yeah. So you can imagine without any prior warning, there has been a lot of kind of confusion and back and forth what that means. Teachers are going back in on this Thursday, and then some students are going back in on early next week, but it's still just the students who have opted into remote, which, depending on the school, ranges between 5%. Some have 30%, but most of the schools we work with are in the like 5 to 10% range. So it's still honestly very confusing, because there are students in school. One of our staff members, Kat Tavares, who's been on a prior episode, runs a restaurant management course that is both in person and online. So back in the fall, Kat would have a class that started at 9 a.m. in person, then would have to give them a break, hop on a virtual class that started at 9:30, new in-person class at 10, new virtual class at 10:30. And each of these are about hour-long classes. So it's just a lot of that for the whole year, and definitely sympathize with them. There was a time in the virtual world where things felt like, okay, we can do this. But it is definitely hard to know that there is hope at some point for our restaurant. We are still funding part of our internships in restaurants, but they are still happening. I think we actually got pretty lucky in terms of timing. We had some interns work from about September through November when things started closing down again. And then our next interns are about to start. It's opening, lots of uncertainty, lots of not sure what that means, especially since so many vaccines were happening in public high schools. I'm not sure how that all affects it all, but yeah, we will see.
And the students are, did you lose any students because they decided this was not the industry that they wanted to go into? Did you maintain everybody and they're still interested and hopeful and wanting to become a part of the restaurant industry as professionals? It's a really interesting time in a young person's life, just generally navigating all this, but navigating something of going into, an industry that, every day on the news, all we see is doom and gloom. That has to have some sort of impact on kids.
Yeah, I think there are, that was actually kind of a silver lining of the pandemic of when I guess it was March 15th last year, when every single one of our interns was laid off on the same day. We had some time to kind of plan for the fall and figure out how we were going to do this in a pandemic world, which meant that we were able to open up the internship program to other avenues of we had two interns at Cherry Bomb Magazine. We had some at Chef's Warehouse. We had some kind of at Ash Hospitality. So doing not just culinary internships, which even in the past, it was about 50% of the students were interested in straight culinary. And the other ones, love Food Network shows. And they were 14 when they decided, but they didn't actually want to go into a kitchen. So I think with opening that up, plus projects like Pass the Spatula, which you mentioned, which the issue last spring was about highlighting food pioneers of color. And then they're working on a Pass the Spatula 2.0 this year, which actually is about food insecurity, food sovereignty, and food justice, which I am really excited to see what students who have just been through a year of pandemic have to say on all of those subjects. So I think it's actually opened the students' mind up to the entirety of the world of food. Because we were able to fund some of the stipends of the students in restaurant internships, that actually allowed the restaurants to kind of have an extra body that they didn't need to pay for directly, and allowed the students to still get some experience. So there were some upsides. They are definitely scared to have spent so much time, especially the alums, training for an industry that they're not sure what it will look like. But I think they've also had more conversations than ever about kind of what their place in that will look like, what role they can play in that, how they can help create more equity, more sustainability in whatever the future of that industry looks like.
Well, one of the reasons why I always like talking with you and the students and the other educators at Food and Finance High School and the Food Education Fund is that inexplicably, sometimes there is this just tremendous positivity and like love for the industry and moving forward. It's really, and it's very reliable. Every time you come on the show, you have something like that to say about. And then we made this thing and we did this and people helped us and donated and the kids were great and they went to work and we kept going. And it's really, It's always good to hear and always something we want to try and shine a light on. So I note the clock and we're running close to being out of time. I'll just ask each of you, thoughts on the one-year anniversary, either personally or professionally, and what's the thing you're most looking forward to? Deep tea?
I think I'm looking forward to more and more people being vaccinated and being able to finally feel a little safe again. I haven't really interacted with much of my family other than the immediate family members and even friends. And I think that is something I'm looking forward to, is just in-person interaction in the most responsible way possible, obviously. but I miss people. Like I, you know, yes, we've been able to do things more efficiently by doing things remotely in our homes and people are more productive or whatever, but I like wasting time sometimes when it comes to just grabbing a drink with somebody or just like talking things through, and having in-person events and like, you know, seeing people's body language, because that has a huge effect on me as a person. And I've so dearly missed it. And so I'm definitely looking forward to more and more people being vaccinated and having those responsible and safe interactions with people. Because I do miss seeing you, right? I miss like watching you do your thing and, you know, like just like watching everybody do their thing in there and be in their element. As much as I miss Roberta's, I miss just like doing podcasts in person as well and things like that. Not having to figure out how to do the recording on my end, just having the technicians and the people that are experts do their job. So
it would also be nice to see people's faces.
Yeah.
Because when you get to see people, that's great. But I'm remarking more and more of just how strange that is. You really lose so much of a person's expressiveness when you can't see 75% of their face.
Yeah, exactly.
Deepti, do you think that your business Food to Eat will continue in a service sort of nonprofit venue even when the corporate side comes back online?
Yeah, I mean, we're still figuring out what to do, right? We were a for-profit and then pivoted into this nonprofit type of work. I think I'm just still trying to navigate what comes next. But in the meantime, as long as we're able to get these grants and we're able to continue doing the food insecurity work, because I don't see a huge amount of relief coming on the government side, we'll keep doing it. In the meantime, we're trying to work with elected officials to see what kinds of policies need to be in place so that, you know, when and if something like this happens again, that we're not in this huge shitty place, right? Like where there's like hundreds of organizations like us, like Eliza, like that are trying to figure this out, because that's not how it should be, right? Systems should be in place where people that need the help get the help when they need it, not 10 months later, not a year later. And so that's something that I'll be concentrating my time on, is just working with legislators and elected officials to figure out what can be done so that in the future that this isn't the place that we're in, and that we're not depending on, you know, hundreds of us starting our own GoFundMe pages, because that's not what GoFundMe started for, right? Like 10 years ago, GoFundMe was for you to start your own project, but not to solve food insecurity.
And save industries and businesses and...
Yeah,
people.
Exactly.
And not so that we don't want to do that collectively or have a society where we want to help each other, but on a structural, institutional, you know, fundamental level, that's not
exactly
people's jobs.
Exactly. That's my point, right? Like obviously I will keep doing this because when I see a need, when I see someone hurting, like I will go out and do the work, right? I was out in the heat of the pandemic last year, like delivering food. And I've been doing that for the past year. And I'm grateful that I had the ability to even do that, right? My husband was watching our kids while I was going out doing that kind of work. But again, it shouldn't fall on my shoulders only. Like there has to be more. So, and that's what I want to work on like more of a long-term you know, process, as opposed to what's the short term that we can all do ourselves, because we'll all roll up our sleeves and do it. But what else can we do so that in the long term, these aren't the things that are happening?
Eliza, what are your thoughts for the coming time? And what are you most looking forward to?
Yeah, I've just been kind of nodding my head the whole time of all of that. I think I'm kind of thinking on kind of the immediate term, the short and the long. And the immediate, I kind of go back to what you're saying, Jen, about like a marathon of, I think we really need to do a better job of recognizing that we've all been in this for a year. Obviously at different levels of stress and trauma and anxiety, but we've all been in this for a year and we are kind of going on turbojets, and especially with the virtual meeting world of it used to be of, you know, if you had to go to a meeting, that was 3 or 4 hours of your day, you know, going there, during the meeting, talking after, and now it's, you know, 8 or 9 a day, just back to back to back. And I think there's just a lot of that. It's I think, draining, and I think we're all tired, and I think we, and I'm also talking to myself, just need to do a better job of creating space for each other, having grace for each other. On kind of the medium term of definitely also echo what Deepti was saying of I hope that we can take this opportunity, because I do think it's an opportunity of, I don't think the restaurant industry will ever have a chance to have a reset like this to create a more sustainable and equitable industry. We on our end are trying two different things, but they're small scale. One of them is creating an accelerator for our alumni to start businesses that are community businesses, not kind of the next unicorn. And another one is kind of totally out of the realm of is working with actually Shake Shack to train their shift managers to hopefully be able to be promoted to exempt managers, and also working with Shake Shack to identify some of the reasons that they haven't been promoted, whether that is structural racism or gender discrimination or anything like that. And today somebody just got promoted, which is super exciting. But so I think that's the type of thing we never would have done before the pandemic, because it's so outside of the box. But I do think we all need to be thinking in that way of, we probably have about 6 months left before the restaurant industry is back. And I think now is the time to really be thinking about who gets to own restaurants. How do we make these structures more sustainable financially, more sustainable emotionally, and more equitable? And then in terms of looking forward to it, definitely seeing our students, because as you were saying, Jen, of the, like, I think the positivity just comes from like looking at 16-year-old faces that have, you know, hope and positivity and wanting to give them something to be excited about.
Can you live stream that for us?
Yes. We had a call yesterday about Pass the Spatula 2.0, and they're just so excited, and that I think gives me energy.
Well, both of you have made some really, really great points that I think are universal. You know, I think it's good to look back and assess. If you don't assess things, you know, you can't make changes going forward or keep doing the thing that works. The other thing is that because we just don't know, it is important to take those breaks and, you know, whatever that, like the physical break, the mental break, the sleep break, the people break, the Zoom break, all of those things. And it is a time where it's almost like anything goes. And I don't mean that in a sort of like violent anarchy kind of way, like, you know, just go out and burn the house down kind of thing. I don't mean that, but I do mean that everybody understands what a cataclysmic time this has been, and no one will question a business's shift or pivot or change in the way they want to work going forward, because everyone will get it and you don't have to explain it. You won't have to sell it to the customer or explain it to the media or the journalist or even, you know, your staff or the people that you're hiring. You know, if you on a menu said that our burger is $35 because all of our employees work full time, have health benefits and paid vacation, and that's what it costs, people would say, oh, okay, I get it. And maybe those types of things will be the new things that we read about restaurants and that we see on menus, instead of, you know, learning the name of the person who grew, you know, the beautiful heirloom vegetables, which is also extremely important and was an indicator to customers how thoughtful the restaurant was and why the price points are what they are. Now maybe we have a different mile marker or value point for how we are going to decide what we want to pay for and what we don't want to pay for. I was watching an interview on Instagram, New York Times, with the designer Tom Ford, and he was, you know, in his empty atelier in Los Angeles. And the interviewer, who's Vanessa Friedman, the fashion editor of the Times, she talked about many of the, you know, prejudices, business issues, racism, you know, all the sins of the fashion industry, environmentalism, fast fashion, all of those things, how it's just, you know, a lot of change. And, you know, similar to the restaurant industry, the fashion industry has been talking about things they need to change. Designers want fewer shows. They want to do 2 shows a year, not 16. They want to, you know, decrease the footprint and do all these things. And she asked him, do you think that will happen when the world comes back? And he says, you know, I would love for it to happen. And we're trying to make these things happen. But at the end of the day, I don't think it is going to happen because we've trained the consumer to want something specific. They're going to want something new every month or every 2 months. And so we will have to, you know, once that machine turns back on, we'll have to feed that machine, in essence, is what he was saying. So I thought it was a very honest response from him and maybe not a very hopeful one. But I think it's still early enough in our collective recovery. I'm not quite sure where we are. It's hard to know on the upswing, but I do feel like we're on the upswing. You know, when we come, whenever we get to come outdoors and we get to go back to our restaurants and see our people's faces and be close to them and squeeze into a place and, you know, go to sporting events in the theater, you know, don't forget about the time and don't forget about the things that were meaningful and don't go back to just wanting the cheapest, freest thing that you can get, because the cheapest, freest thing you can get nearly broke everything. So hopefully businesses will have the courage and the wherewithal to make some of those changes, which will be hard. Hopefully the government will support them in making those changes, both in terms of policy and dollars. And hopefully the consumer will understand that to have better things, everybody has to make a contribution. And sometimes that's financial and sometimes that's time. And if you want it to be better, everybody has to sort of make that effort. So I'm hopeful, and I do hope that a lot of the things that people have talked about actually become realities, and they do articulate them when they reopen restaurants and we go back and all those things happen. And, you know, with, you know, women like you leading organizations who are trying to make these changes at the grassroots level or at the early stages with students who will become, you know, the chefs and the business owners of tomorrow, I mean, I think we can all be hopeful, you know, that at least we're aware and somebody's doing something. So I want to thank Deepti Sharma and Eliza Lower for joining me today on this look back episode for the year of the pandemic. Ladies, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And I want to thank the staff at Heritage Radio Network. I want to thank Matt for continuing to do an amazing job and keeping us all going. It has been a really good anchor in my life and hopefully a little bit of an anchor in our listeners' lives as well. If you are a listener and you want to help anchor us and make us have a bright future, go to heritageradionetwork.org, click the beating heart. And, you know, if you can, maybe throw us what you would have spent on that coffee today. It'll help us keep the lights on, make more radio, and stay connected and record our stories of these times, which we will want to have in years to come. I'm Jennifer Liuzzi, and this is Tech Bytes.
Tech Bytes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.